Last night, we ended up pretty much, if I remember right, and my memory isn't what it used to be. But you see, I'm more than 40 years old now. And but if I remember right, we left off after the appraisal committee had seen the village. Isn't that about right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's where I'll start in now then. And that was still in 1960. Well, we had been through the four people. It was Ed Autumn and Vic Nelson, Randy Stein, and Earl Van Kirk, and myself. We came up here to appraise these property. I'm telling you this because some of you weren't here last night. We came up here as a feasibility committee to inspect the village and appraise it and determine whether or not it was a feasible, whether the thing would fly or not, as a Lutheran venture. Well, we spent the 2 days looking through the village. We went through every room in this village, and we went through all the buildings in the mine area. We went through the ballpark area and the miners' village, and just about everything around here. And we were determined that we had made a thorough inspection of everything that was visible. And the only thing we couldn't see was the plumbing and the wiring that was hidden. And there was no water in the water system, and there was no electricity in the village. So we had no way to determine whether or not that was in condition or not. But we had hopes that since everything else was so beautifully done, basically constructed and all, that the rest of it would be comparable. And later on we found that that was true. But we did anticipate that we'd have a lot of leaks in the village, in the water system, and that was true. I told you last night that, for instance, the dining hall, that thing was dripping water out of every tile up there. It was just like being in a shower when we turned the water on. And that was one of the major problems that we had, was to repair all the plumbing in the village. And so when we walked down the road from the mine area, the five of us, we felt very good about what we had accomplished. We walked down the street and we stopped out here in front of the schoolhouse, where our car was parked, Oscar Getty's old Chevrolet. It was a sunburned car that we borrowed down at the village in return for checking his horse up here. And we stood in a circle there, and we said, "Now, we've seen it all. What do we think?" And before I could say anything, my friend, new friend, Vic Nelson spoke up, and he says, "There's one thing that concerns me," he says. "I know we have mixed feelings about this whole thing, but right now our responsibility is to appraise this village and determine whether or not it's feasible. And we are the committee that's responsible. We can expand it if we wish, but we are not organized as a committee. So who's going to take charge from now on and coordinate the work that we have to do before we can determine whether it is a feasible thing or not?" I was about to speak up when he spoke up again, and he says, "Well, I've been thinking about it," and he says, "Gil, will you handle it? Will you be the chairman?" And I hesitated for a bit. And I admitted that I was one that was probably as possible, I was as positive about this place as anyone, but that I had some mixed feelings too. And I thought, "Well, Vic, you fellows, any one of you could handle this job. But maybe your job situation in the city is such that you can't do it. Can you spare any time now in carrying this thing forward?" And Ed spoke up. He says, I'll have to be in school all week. And Randy Stamm says, I'm a student. I'll be in school. And Mr. The electrician said, well, I live way over in Kent, and I have no chance whatsoever to get off my work. So, and Vic says, Gil, will you take it? And I hesitated again for a minute, and I says, well, God willing, I'll take it. And right then and there, I determined that I would spend at least a couple of weeks away from my business, and I would try to get the thing going. And we shook hands on this, and that's all the organization we did. We shook hands on the deal that I would be the chairman. And we immediately boarded our rusty old car out there, and we got into it, and when we settled into our seats, why, Vic Nelson was had his big foot on the wheel, on the gas pedal, and down the road we went. And before we got to 10 Mile Creek, I thought to myself, well, now this is a chance to relax and give this thing some thought. And so we were about talked out anyway. We'd been talking all morning for 5-6 hours, and we were tired because we had crawled over these hills and way up to the falls and all over this place. And we were somewhat short of sleep, too. We'd only had about 4 hours sleep the night before. And the night before that, we hadn't slept much because we left Seattle at 4:30 in the morning. And we'd been really working. So I relaxed, and then I began to talk to myself. I said to myself, Gil, you've got yourself into something here. What are you going to do about it? One voice said to me, you fell in love with the place the minute you came into the village, didn't you? And I said, yes, that's right. Another voice said, Gil, but you saw some things you didn't like here too, didn't you? That was the other side of the mixed bag of feelings talking to me. And I said, yes, I saw some things I didn't like, but I also saw some things that overrode all those negative things. And Gil, then the positive voice said to me, Gil, you like the flowers and you like the mountains, you like the flowers and the fauna, you like just about everything you saw. You even liked something about the tailings pile over there, in spite of the fact that it's a pile of dust. But it's some beauty in it and all that. Yes, that's true. And I like the footbridge, and but most of all, I like the structural soundness of this village. That meant more to me than anything else. You know, when you think of mining villages and lumber camps and the like, you think of shacks, poorly built for maybe 5 or 10 years. But this was built for many, many years to come, and that was so evident. We determined that almost from the very beginning when we inspected the house number one. It was number one all the way through with the materials and the labor and the whole thing. And we found that to be true of everything in the village. It was well done. We gave House On Mining Company high marks for what they had done in providing this beautiful place. Well, I kept talking to myself all the way down almost to the top of the switchback. And at that point, one of the men said, slow down, Vic. And Vic stepped on the brakes, and the cloud of dust, we were enveloped in it because it had followed us all the way down. You know, this was a dusty road, and we were driving fast because we didn't have any time to spare. And that brought me to. And I had just about determined to tell the boys what I'd been thinking about. That the positive points about this village outdid the negatives by 2-1. And that I thought that maybe it would be a bit premature to say that this thing's got to fly. But I didn't have time, because we were then starting the downhill portion of the switchback. And then I thought about all the, as we were going down that tortured drive, I thought about all the buses that we would need to carry people up here, and the trucks and all that, and how important it would be that they would be sound buses and trucks. And that was one of the things that frightened us a little bit. We wondered what we'd do about the Flatlanders that would come up here, because I'd already determined that this had to be a national thing. And I knew that the people in Minnesota and Iowa and the Dakotas and California and all over didn't have anything like this, and they'd be wild to come up here, and that they would want to participate. But how would we ever get them up that hill? You know, those people on the flatlands are very conservative people, except in politics. They will try anything. They're nice people, and I knew they'd want to come, but I didn't know how we'd get them up here. They'd be scared to death. So I thought, well, maybe we could get some buses with no windows in them. And maybe we could put them in trucks and put blankets over them so they couldn't see them. We had all kinds of provisions for taking care of the Flatlanders. But anyway, we made the bottom of the hill, and we were glad for that. And then we inspected the dock down there, and we found that to be in real good shape. And the marine ways were still there, where they had pulled out their tugs and barges and overhauled them and the like of that. We determined that they were of no value to us. But the crane was on the dock, and that was a tremendous sponsor of a crane, one-armed bandit, and it was a big, powerful machine, and it would take some experts to run a thing like that. And we didn't have a lot of experts in that field that I knew about. But in a way, and we didn't know who owned that. There were a lot of things we didn't know. There were so many unknowns about this thing. We didn't know whether the Forest Service, for instance, whether they had approved this gift to LBI or not. And there was a lot of things. We didn't know what the contract between the people that were salvaging the steel up on the hill, and what their contract was. Were they going to continue now that we had been given this thing? There was so many things, and all we knew was that we'd had a telephone call. Wes Preeb had a telephone call indicating that the mining company was willing to give it to LBI, but we didn't know what the strings were. So this was a surprising gift dumped in the lap of LBI, who didn't have any money to operate it. And we had no entity whatsoever organized to operate it and to raise the funds and recruit the people that would be necessary to renovate it and all. So there was a lot of unknowns. But anyway, I had faith that on the boat trip down the lake, after we nearly missed the boat, we sat out on the deck, and at that point, my companions were starved to death because we hadn't had any lunch. We'd had breakfast at 7 in the morning or 6:30 in the morning under the trees over there, and they had accused me of being a poor Norwegian because I didn't drink their coffee. And they complained about being awfully hungry, and that they were surprised that I was still on my feet. Well, I reminded them about the fact that they had said that I would run out of gas before they did, because I didn't have any coffee in my tank. Well, they ran out of gas before I did. But anyway, we went down the lake, and we had a very wonderful dinner at Leavenworth in a restaurant that became quite famous the whole nights in the years that followed. And on the way home that night, We discussed what we had seen, and we talked about a lot of things that needed to be done. But we decided then and there that we had to have a plan of action. And I was appointed to work on a plan of action the very next day that would provide some continuity to what we had to accomplish before we could say that it was a feasible project. And the very next morning, I got up early and I rushed down to my office in Ballard. I had a private office there, and I told my crew what we had seen and what I was up against, that I would probably be absent for a while. And I asked them if that would be okay with them. I didn't have to ask that because I was the owner. But I asked them if they would miss me for a couple of weeks. I thought we might accomplish this in 2 weeks. You see, our responsibility was only as a feasibility committee, as far as we knew. And after we determined whether it was feasible or not, then our duties would be over. So I'd accepted a job that had some limitations to it. But I had no idea that I would become involved the way it happened later on. So that morning I spent all morning long laying out a plan. Number one, I said, we have to contact the House on Mining Company in New York. And we have to determine then whether or not there's any strings to this gift. All that we had was a telephone call. We had no written confirmation, and so we were left without a lot of information that we needed. So that was number one on the list. Number two on my list was to contact the Forest Service to determine whether or not they were willing to give us a permit. We knew that we'd have to have a permit to operate on Forest Service ground. You know, these buildings are on Forest Service ground, and the mine properties we have deed to. You should know that. Well, that was number two. And that was the thing that bothered me the most. What in the world would we do if the Forest Service came up with a long string of do's and don'ts, and whether they would provide the necessary permits for our operation? And then, of course, we had the water system to think about. And that, I think, I made number three, and the electrical energy problem, that was number four. And those things we had to investigate before we determined whether or not it was going to be feasible. And so, after about 3 hours of intense concentration in that office, I called my friend Vic Nelson, who I'd known just 2 days, but I'd learned to love the guy already. He was that kind of a guy. He was a big Swede, and I don't ordinarily say anything nice about Swedes. But he was one good one, and we used to roast him a lot about being a Swede, and I like to roast the Swedes about being Swedes. But I have found some good ones amongst them, too. And I've learned to love their meatballs, even in Sweden. Well, I met with Vic. He took time off. I went down to his furrier shop in downtown Seattle, and he showed me through his shop and showed me what it took to, how many skins it took to make a fur coat, and all those things. He had a very interesting shop and a lot of beautiful things in that shop. And then we had lunch together, and I submitted the plan that I had for operating. We had already decided on the way back from Holden that day that we would meet on the following Friday at my home and we would invite some people that we knew had some clout to meet with us so we could tell them about what we had found. Not necessarily the people from LBI, but people we knew as friends and people who had some clout in the churches that they belonged to. And he approved everything that I had jotted down on my plan. And so we met the next Friday night. And this was a very important meeting in telling these new people. We wanted to expand this committee because we knew that we would need some experts in different fields. And the more people we could tell the story to, the more chance we would have in finding the right people. So from that point on, there was a series of meetings with this committee and with the board at LBI and with various people before we determined to tell LBI that we thought it was a feasible and a possible venture. And that took some time. In the meantime, I made some trips to Chelan to visit the county commissioners there and the PUD people regarding the electrical energy problem. And I found out that they were willing to restore the line all the way from Manson to Holden Village. And they were going to do it for much less than it cost. And they would give us the most favorable rates and all of that. They were very helpful. I was so surprised that we found this kind of attitude amongst these public officials. They were great. And so we learned what it would cost, and this was part of our study. And it was also we learned how much it would cost to maintain that line over the years. And this was very helpful. And then I made a call to the Forest Service. And that was the thing that bothered me the most, as if I had any negative feelings, it was about dealing with the government on this thing. And I thought, well, boy, if we don't get along with those people, well, this thing will really be a big white elephant. And it would have been. And when I made the appointment, I got the idea. I had a feeling that these people that I talked to were favorable. And so I called Dr. Laverne Rickey, who was a prominent Lutheran in Seattle, a law professor at the University of Washington, who became the first president of the board, and a well-respected Lutheran gentleman. Asked him if he would go with me over to Wenatchee and meet with the Forest Service officials. And he immediately said, yes, I'll surely do that. He was brought up in the Leavenworth area, and he knew a lot about Holden and about this whole area, brought up there, and his whole family was lived in this area at one time. And I knew some of his brothers. His brother, in fact, was the president of the Board of Trustees at LBI at the time. And I knew his brother, Mark, who was the youth director in the ELC for some years. And I learned to know his parents, too. Well, I tell you, this visit to the Forest Service relieved me tremendously. The minute we walked into that office, I knew we were amongst friends, and Christian friends at that. They had to be Christians because their attitude was the attitude of a really good Christian. Right away, they expressed the opinion that there would be no problems whatsoever in getting a permit. In fact, they had been looking for somebody that would qualify. And it seemed that a church group like this would be the answer to their prayer for somebody to take this thing over. They knew they had a big problem up here. If somebody didn't take it over, they would have to burn this village down like they burned the miners' village down, because they couldn't let it stand the way it did. It was a threat to the whole forest area. And so right away we learned that we were amongst friends. And I think that remained, that eliminated the main problem as far as I was concerned. I thought the thing was feasible from that point on. The lack of electricity in the village, the lack of many things in the village didn't bother me. Those things could be overcome if we could just find the right people. And at that point, that was the job that was before us, to find the right people to organize this thing. And after several months of meeting with various people and with various organizations and talking to many people in many churches, we had pictures, and already we were offering workshops in many of the Lutheran churches in the Seattle and Tacoma area, telling about the Holden Village and what we had planned to do, and we got a lot of positive response. We brought a busload of people up here one day in September from the Seattle area mostly, just so we could get their opinion about this place. We brought them up here and gave them a very wonderful lunch on arrival. And we showed them through the village and up in the mine area. We took them around in the equipment that we had. And most of them seemed to be in line with what we thought, that this was a wonderful thing to develop. So we did a lot of things before we had a meeting with LBI and determined that to recommend that LBI accept the deed to the properties that were transferable, and to accept the gift from the Hausau Mining Company. And that wasn't until after LBI too had met with their faculty and decided that at one of their meetings they decided that they would like to tackle it themselves. But they really didn't know what they were up against, because they didn't have the clout that was necessary to do this thing. And we recommended that this had to be a national venture. So I think it was in October that we met with lawyers in the law offices downtown, Pastor Slam and myself. We went to their law offices that represented the Hounsall Mining Company, and we were handed the deed. And if you read the book that Charles Lutz wrote, The Surprising Gift, you'll see a picture of Pastor Slam and I accepting that deed. And after that, then the problem was, well, who's going to operate? Is LBI going to do it, or is there going to be a new entity? And right away it was recommended by not only us, but by some pretty good minds that LBI would not be able to put this thing over because of their program. They had all they could do as it was. So we immediately then decided that we would have to contact the various synods. And it happened that I was due to go back to Minneapolis or to Minnesota for a young people's convention, and immediately thought of people that I knew back there, that I had established a relationship over the years in the Luther League work and in the college work and all of that, that these people would, there were certain people there that I would have to see regarding the establishment of a relationship with the various synods. And right away I thought of Dr. Merton Strumman. I'm sure that most of you have heard that name, haven't you? At the time, he was the youth rector of the LFC Youth Department, and he later started the Lutheran Research, and he is still active in that. Although he is retired, he is still active in the research movement. I had known him for a long time, and I thought very highly of him. He came to Seattle as a boy when his father was called to Bethany Church, where I was a member. His father was called to be pastor there. And over the years, through Luther League work and conventions and the like, we had established a deep friendship. And I thought, well, this is my opportunity to tell him about Holden. And I thought to myself, if I could get that one person to tell me that this was something that the church could use, then I would recommend that we proceed. Well, I went back there, and at that convention, I had a part in the program there. I think it was at St. Olaf College. And he was quite impressed. I showed him the pictures, and I told him the story as much as I knew of it. And we made a deal that he would come out as soon as possible, that I would take him up here and take him on a tour of the village. We'd spend 2 days up here. And within several weeks, he was in Seattle. We drove to Chelan. We got the same old truck from Oscar Getty at the station down there. We drove up here, and I gave him almost the same tour that we took as a feasibility committee. I wanted to see him everything. And we spent 2 days doing that. We spent the night down at the resort at the village, and there we saw bedding that had House on Mining Company stamps on it. So we knew where some of the bedding belonged. And we also saw some chairs down there that looked just like this one. And we knew exactly where that came from. And we determined then that all the resorts up and down the lake had property that belonged up here, because this village had been open all during those years, and people had helped themselves. Well, after the second day, when we had finished this tour of the village with this good and dear friend, we stood out there in front of the schoolhouse, and I said to Merton Strumman, "Mert, tell me now, is this something that the church, on the national level, can use?" He says, "Gil, I'm overly impressed." He says, "This, in my opinion, is a gift from God. We must take it and make use of it." And that's all I needed to hear. From then on, I proceeded on the basis that this was a going thing. And then, of course, we had to recruit other people. And there were other people that I knew. And I forgot to tell you about Wes Preed. Of course, I missed him last night, too. Well, Wes Preed is in the village at the present time, and if you haven't met him, you should meet him. He's the guy that triggered this thing, the whole thing. He wrote the letters that invited this invitation. I don't think he really invited them to give it to the LBI, but he asked about the availability of it. And I think he was as surprised as I was when he got the phone call that they had decided to give it to LBI. And so I think if you haven't met Wes, you owe it to yourself to meet him. He's quite a character. He doesn't know one end of a shovel from another, but there's a lot of things he does know. And he's quite a guy. So I want you to know that he's a personality that means an awful lot to this Holden development. And then we began to think about others that we could involve. And I thought, well, the thing to do is to go back east again, and we meet all these youth directors at one time. And so I determined to do that. I went back in October, and we had a preliminary meeting with Mert Drummond had arranged for all the youth directors to meet at a certain breakfast place, and we had breakfast together. There I met Mr. Brown, or Pastor Brown, who was a director of youth in the ELC, and Dr. Bergstrand, youth director of the Augustana Synod, and Luther Strumman, who was the youth director of the LFC. Those were the people that we met with that morning. And that's where I had a chance to sell this thing to these other fellows. And later on that day, we met with not only the ELC group, but there were also people from these other departments where they could view a movie that I took with me, the Alps of the Stehekin. It was a wonderful movie that helped promote Holden Village. It was produced by one of the environmental groups of the U.S. And this did a wonderful job with those people. They saw what Holden looked like, and they saw what this entire region looked like, Image Lake and Stehekin and all the beautiful areas above here, which is really paradise above here. And then I gave my pitch about what we had found up here, and they were as surprised as anyone that the gift had been given and that was available. And right away I could sense that we had their cooperation. Now, how else could you approach these synods except through one of their agencies? You couldn't go directly to, for instance, headquarters of the ELC and the LFC and the Augustana and all that. They only meet about every two years, and it takes an act of Congress to get anything going through those channels. So we determined that the thing to do to get established with the national church was through the youth bodies. And this is what we proceeded to do. And immediately these people came out. Dr. Brown appointed Joe Bash, his assistant, to be on this committee. We made them members of our interim committee. Mert Strumman came out, and Dr. Bergstrand came out, and we spent 2 days in brainstorming this thing and determining what we would do with the place. Now, that's a long story, and I'm not going to go all into it, but you know, if you want some help, you've got to choose people that have know-how, that have dedication, and that they have a love for the Lord. And all three of these people met those requirements. They were wonderful people, wonderful friends, and they did an awfully big job in helping promote Holden Village in the early years. And then the time came in 1961 to recruit crews to come up here and start this renovation process. And this is most interesting. The Augustana Church had already promised us that they would do the recruitment the first year, and that they would pay with the ELC and the LFC and the Augustana would pay the cost of their board and room here at the village, which which was $3 a day that we had determined, that it would be $3 a day. And that was their contribution that year. Well, they recruited then the first camp group that came up, and there were about 42 people. They were recruited from all over the U.S., a lot of them from Minnesota, some from the North Dakota, some from the state of Washington, some from California, some from Texas. And I can tell you that Dr. Bertrand did a tremendous job in recruiting and selecting these wonderful people. And when they came into Chelan on the 15th of June in 1961, I met with them there, and we spent the night there. We met in a little church, the little church there at Chelan, and there we outlined what we had in mind for them to do. We introduced ourselves, Dr. Bertrand, of course I had met him, and I had wanted to bring him to the village too, and I forgot to tell you that the only way I could get him into the village was later on in the winter, and at that time the roads were blocked, there was no way you could drive in here. So we chartered a plane in Seattle and we flew up here, and I had to be the guide to find this place in the winter time. We stopped in Yakima, or Ellensburg, I mean, and loaded up some gas there, and from there on, the pilot didn't have any idea where Holden Village was, so I told him to fly down to the Columbia River and follow that to Lake Chelan, and Chelan to Luzerne, and then up this valley. And we circled this valley in midwinter, and there must have been 8 feet of snow on the ground, and the village was covered, but it was still beautiful. And we circled this thing several times, and it was a scary thing because there isn't much room between these peaks, you know. And Dr. Bergstrand gave his approval. He says, this is wonderful. And of course, what we saw back here, image, Glacier Peak and Bonanza and all those things, was a bright sunny day. Everything was out, and the view of the mountains, it was stupendous. You couldn't describe it. And so he was at the Lake Chelan Church there with his dear wife, Dolores, a most wonderful person. And we outlined then what we had in mind for this group to do. Right away you could sense that these were not just ordinary kids. They were college students. But they were dedicated people. They had gone to great lengths to screen that. They had many more offers than they needed, but they screened them so well that they came up with people that were dedicated to this thing. And we told them what we wanted them to do. We outlined what they would find up here. They wouldn't find any plumbing. There wasn't toilet working in the whole village. There was no water in the mains. Yes, there was water by that time. We'd already turned that on. But there was no plumbing, and there was no cooking instruments. There was just nothing. And would they be willing to live under a situation like that? And they said, well, we'd love that. And they did. We came up lake and came into this village, and within, by that time, I had Bertha Pearson up here, the cook. And if you know anything about the history of Holden, you got to know something about Bertha Pearson. She was the LBI cook at the LBI. And over the years, I had eaten there many times for board meetings and the like, and determined that she had the best food in the city. She could cook for hundreds of people and make it taste like it was home cooked. And we had brought her up here in advance, a couple of days in advance of the arrival of this group. And the first thing we did, we unloaded the truck. By that time we had a truck, and they all came up in that. And in quick order we had a wonderful lunch. We had fried chicken, and we fried it over a fireplace stove out there behind house two. And we right away they organized themselves. Dr. Bernstein was very helpful in organizing this group, and they already had determined to call themselves the Forerunners, because they were the first camp crew, the work crew that come into the village, called themselves the Forerunners. They became very famous in this development. Believe me, over the years they did more than any other work group. They've been back here every 5 years in a reunion. They were here last year, and they did more to promote the village in the Midwest and other states than any other group has. They were a tremendous group. And all but about two of them were determined that they were going to work real hard. And we told them that they were going to have to work when they came up here, that it was going to be a ministry of sweat and dirty hands, and they'd have to live under substandard situations. But they loved it. They just absolutely loved it. Right away we started the renovation, and the first thing we did was to broom clean the village. That is, we went through house after house and took out all the garbage and all the papers and everything, and we hauled it up to the dump. And then we swept out one building after another. We took two or three at a time and divided the group. Most of them were in the work camp. Some of them were designed to, or they were to be on a cook and camp crew to help the cook and to make the beds and do housework. And others were designated to saw wood. And others were to push brooms and do cleanup work. And before the week was over, we had all these buildings broom cleaned, and we had held up truckloads of junk. And I mean lots of junk. And then we started to clean it, one by one. And that took the rest of that month. The biggest job was in the hotel. That place was so dirty, you just wouldn't believe it. The grease was an inch thick on the ranges and back of the ranges and up above in the rafters and all. And it took a lot of time to repair the roof where the chimney had fallen over and broken through. And we had rebuilt the chimneys in the village. There was a mason amongst those young people, a farmer boy. He knew how to lay brick like a veteran. I think he was the oldest one in the group, and I think he was about 26 years old. I got to tell you about some of those characters. There's some of them that were really characters. They were full of fun, all of them. And there was two of them that really didn't like the work. One of them was so full of questions. Everything he was told to do, he had to know why and how to do it. And so I finally lost a little patience with him one day. I said, "Do you have to know everything before you do something?" And from then on, he shut up. He just... Then we had a boy from Texas. Got to tell you about him. We called him Tex. And one morning, he determined that he'd like to take a rest. You know, we got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and by 7 o'clock, breakfast was all over, and everybody was ready to go to work. But he determined that, boy, he's going to have a day off. Well, he was mistaken. The girls in this group were so motivated to work that they weren't going to have anybody in camp that didn't work. And he had locked himself in his room up there in chalet number 3, and nobody could get at him. But, you know, they found a ladder and raised it up to his window, and they crawled into that thing and carried him out, sleeping bag and all, and dumped him into the pool back there. And that pool was full of ice water. And from then on, Tex got up every morning, and he was just as nice as anybody else. He really learned early in the game that there was no loafers allowed in this camp. That was really one of the incidents. It was a lot of fun. And it taught somebody some lessons. A lot of people worked hard. We got up early and we worked hard till about 1 o'clock. And after lunch, they were free to do what they wanted. And they hiked these hills and we rained so they could have an overnight. They hiked Image Lake, which is about 15 miles from here, and they hiked to Stehekin. Some of them went there, and some of them went there, and many, all of them practically had an overnight experience during that month. And what they did to this village was a marvel. We repaired so many windows and so many plumbing things, and of course during the week, the weekends usually there would be people coming up from Seattle and Tacoma and various places to work. You know, some of the older people. We had one man I've got to tell you about. He was a retired carpenter. He came up here, I think he was about 72 years old at the time, but he was a marvelous mechanic. He said, "Now, let me tell you what I'd like to do." He said, "I'd like to go through every building in this village, and I'd like to check every door and every main door and cupboard door and see if they're working right." And you know, he spent a whole month doing that. And by the time he left, there wasn't a door in this village that had a squeak or anything that, wrong with it. It was just beautifully done. That was just a sample of the kind of people that came up here and worked. And there's some people sitting in front of me here that I could tell you about too. I could say some negative things about them in fun, but they're really good friends of mine. They came up too one day, and while Sid Knudsen, stand up, Sig, and Gene, stand up. This Sid and Gene Knudsen. And ever since they came up here, we've been close friends. We lived in the same condominium, and we've done an awful lot of things together, and we can blame Holden for a lot of that, can't we? That's right. Gene, you want to tell them what work you were appointed to do? I remember that so well.
Well, we've got our children up here, too.
Speak a little louder.
The first weekend we came up here, we brought our children up, and Sid and the boys were blazing, and a lot of other people were making trail. But Sid, or Gil and I, worked in the great big gym floor, so we scrubbed it, and then the next day we varnished it. And so I thought I was really doing well. All of a sudden I noticed Gil. He was redoing everything I did. just going over the same thing I had done. So I said, "Gilbert, I'll never speak to you again if you do that again to my work, because I'm a good Norwegian housekeeper." And so after that, we were very best friends. He laughed and I laughed, and that was it. We also have beach homes by each other.
Yeah. Why, you'd just be surprised at the hundreds of people that volunteered to come up here. And it was so easy to challenge them. All you had to do was to bring them up here once, and that was all you needed. They were sold on what we were doing, and they joined in, and they pitched in. And many of them were skilled mechanics, and a lot of people were not. But they were all dedicated. And this is what helped put this place over. It was a place for volunteers. You know that first year, what our labor cost us? You would be surprised. We paid the cook $100 a month for 3 weeks, or for 3 months. And we paid the custodian $100 a month for the rest of that year. And he came up here with the understanding that he was to be here all winter, all alone. And that's a story in itself. At the end of the year, We stocked number one there with all the groceries and everything that he would need for the year. And he lived here alone that whole winter. Imagine someone living in this isolated place all alone with a dog. Little old Bugger. I brought Bugger up here when he was about so long. He was just a little black pup. And finally he got to be about so long, and he had legs about that long. And he could hardly walk in the snow because his legs were so short. But he was his companion, and there's a long story about that dog and Reuben, who was the custodian. Reuben came to me before, I think it was in May of 1960, and he was from Minneapolis, and he needed a job. And he was a brother of a man that I knew very well. And I knew that his brother wanted to be helpful in this situation. Reuben had some problems. They were related to alcohol. And when he poured out his story to me, I thought, well, there's some problems in connection with people like that, but boy, maybe this is the place that he needs to be. And I took a chance and told him that he could come on the basis that he wouldn't touch alcohol and that he would remain here over the winter and be perhaps all alone. And that was the deal. And I could write you some stories about that man and about what we did for him and what we attempted to do. It did fail in the end, but while I was here, he was a good boy and people just loved him. He was the horseshoe champion of the village. He could beat anybody that lived here or that came up here. And he was always of service to people. He wasn't a real good mechanic and all, but he was a good custodian. He was dependable. And there's a big story behind that, and I won't go into it now. And there are other people I could tell you about. And this is a people story. This Holden thing. How we involve people. People like, besides these youth directors who became so very helpful. There was Laverne Rickey, for instance, who became the first president when we organized this Holden Village Corporation. He became the first president. And I think he was president of the corporation for something like 15 years. And he comes up here quite often. I listened to one of his tapes just yesterday about the history of Holden. And he talked very much like I am talking now about some of the things that took place here in the beginning years. He had some of his statistics wrong, but boy, I tell you, that man has done an awful lot for the village. And I told you something about Bertha Pearson. She was a grand person, a wonderful Christian, and dedicated, and the people that worked with her for those 3 summers that I was up here, they just loved her. And she made more friends than anybody in the village because her cooking was so wonderful. And we told her that we would give her everything she needed to put on the finest food that's possible for hard-working people, and she surely was the one. At the end of 61, for instance, we had 145 pastors due to come into the village. None of them had been here. And a few days before they arrived, our truck became useless because somebody had left the cap off the radiator. And it had gotten too hot on the switchback, and the head had warped, and it wasn't usable. But luckily, the people that were doing the salvage work up here, they had a truck that was about a mile long, a flat bed truck, and it had holes in it where steel had fallen onto the bed and punched holes in it. It was full of dirt and everything. It was an awful thing, but we asked the service man up there if he would help us in a pinch, and he responded he would be glad to do that. And that, along with some other equipment, was down at the lake. We managed to get them up here. And by that time, all the help had left except Bertha and I and one or two other people. And so she involved me in cooking with her. And that's when I learned how to roll meatballs. And I did that all day long in the sauna that's back of the hotel. That's where I did my work. And I made a million of them, rolled them out, and Bertha baked them. She stirred up the whole mess. And boy, what she put into that was the best meat that could be bought. She put eggs in it and a lot of other things that were made them extra good. We wanted to make an impression on these preachers because they were the people that we wanted to involve in Holden as much as possible. So they came up and they ate and ate and ate, and they loved the food. And when they left the village, there wasn't a crumb left in the village. But while they were here, we had the finest music that you can imagine. The gym at that time was too cold. There was no heat there. We had the hydro plant going by that time, but there was no heaters in there, so we couldn't heat the thing. And so the nights were cold at that time in September, and they couldn't meet in there, so they met out in the street. But before they went out in the street, they'd always use the piano inside there. And when those 140 pastors sat down and sang those hymns together, I'm telling you, they raised the roof. They brought music back to this village, believe me. I've never heard such wonderful singing. And they seem to be so inspired up here, not only to sing, but to eat. And we had a time to feed those people. Bertha and I and several of the pastors had their wives with them. They pitched in and helped, and we even recruited some of the pastors to do some dishes. Well, we had a dishwasher by that time. We had the hydro plant going. The only thing they didn't like about the village, we turned the lights out at 10 o'clock. None of us were willing to stay up after 10 o'clock, and we had to shut them down. And they complained about that. But we said, well, we had to sleep sometime, and we had no one else to turn those machines off. And otherwise, well, that was one another incident. A lot of things took place that year. My goodness, there's too many to talk about. You just can't remember them all, but some of them were so beautiful. But the spirit of everything that was done, it was so wonderful to have people come up here from everywhere. We had offers come in from all the states, and especially from the Midwest, and California, and Oregon. I think as many offers came from out of state as from the state of Washington. And the foreigners, when they left the village, they took pictures with them, whole sets of them, about 40 sets, mind you. Every one of them took a set of pictures, and they had programs in their local churches wherever they came from, and sold Holden Village. And you know, that paid tremendously, because we had letters from all over the country where they had been and sold Holden to them. And some of them were included gifts, and others included offers to come up and work for free, and all of that. So by the end of that year, we had the village pretty well cleaned up, and it was really an accomplishment. And the next year, in 1962, that was the year of the World's Fair in Seattle, and we expected quite a few visitors from all over the United States. And they came, all right. The Augustana Synod had their annual meeting in Seattle. And when that was finished, they brought a busload of their top brass up here to to see the village because Bergstrand had sold them on it. And they came up and they loved this place. We gave them a wonderful lunch and sent them home singing. And they just loved the place, and you should see the results from that. And that was one way that we advertised Holden Village. We did it through the people that came here. And this worked beautifully. Oh, 1962 was a great year too. There was about 4 work camp crews. You see, they were recruited to come up for 1 month. And they all had their names. The Forerunners were the first group, but there was the Undertakers and the Trailblazers. And, oh, they each had a name. And they were all dedicated. They just loved it so much, and they cried when they left. That's how much they loved it. And just as the Forerunners, they went home and sold Holden Village to their home congregations. And this is how this whole thing evolved, through these wonderful people. And you know that by the time that 1963 came along, we had this village in really fine condition. And that's when Carol Hinderly took over, and that's when I left the village in 1960. And at that time, we had cleaned up the village. We'd replaced 800 panes of glass, and everything was in order. We had light in the village, and we had plans for a hydro. We had already started the powerhouse for it. We had the Pelton wheels on the spot, and by the end of that year, we had the hydro going. And so the things that we dreamed about, they were all achieved. And this was something that we could lay to the fact that we had all these volunteers. If you tried to determine the value of the help that we had up here, it would run into hundreds of thousands of dollars. The people that came in, for instance, to install the 2 hydro plants, I mean the 2 diesel plants, they were Presbyterians. They were friends of mine in Seattle. And they were recommended to me, and I asked them if they would be willing to come up here to install those 2 units. They came up on a Friday and they worked 3 days, and by Sunday night we had power in the village. I remember so well that we placed a person in each of the buildings when they turned the lights on. And I was told to be in the basement of the hotel. And so I stood there waiting for the hour that they were going to turn that on. I heard a terrific rumble in one of the mechanical bread mixers. The switch had been left on 3 years earlier, and it came on. It scared me half to death. And no light came on, but this thing started to grow. Well, it was great. And by the time we left the village that fall, Carol was the executive director, and I was the business manager. And we had accomplished the restoration of the village. It was clean, it was healthy, there was good water in all the plumbing, the fireworks were in order, everything was in order, and a lot of the areas around the mine had been cleaned up. Truckloads of debris left over by the wrecking crew, and the many things accomplished that I can't take time to tell you about. But we had a lot to be thankful for. The Lord had really been good. And we had all our bills paid, and we had $40,000 in the bank. Do you have any questions?
I'm speechless.
Yes. Gil, how many years were you working on it before Hinderly took over?
My work started in 1960 and ended at the end of 1963, so it'd be 4 years. And I was a volunteer with the rest of them. And our only payroll was the cook and the custodian.
Did you ever get any of the furniture back that everybody took?
Pardon?
The furniture, did you ever get any of it back?
Were you found by the beach and so on?
You had mentioned some of the resorts had furniture.
But I could tell you about the blankets. You know, they were here when we praised the village. But when we came back later on that year, they were gone. There was a pack train that had come in from the west side, we learned later, and they had loaded up all those blankets. There were thousands of dollars worth of blankets and pillows, and we lost them all. So we had to buy blankets, and we had to buy a lot of beds. And I remember one time sending up 100 beds that we had bought in Seattle from one firm, and we bought a lot of dishes that we needed in addition to what was left. That hotel was loaded with dishes of all kinds. They had saved the chipped ones even and put them up in the third floor. There's a one great big room, if you have a chance, go up to that hotel and see what it amounts to. There's one great big room, and that room was filled with tables of every kind of hotel equipment that you could imagine. It was just like a museum. They had saved the old dishes as well as there was a lot of new ones. So it was something.
Was the family housing given to LBI too, or was that part of the original package or not? There was some family housing down here, I believe.
The family, you mean the miners' village?
Yes.
The Forest Service had control of that, and they wanted to give that to us, but we refused it. All we took was some of the copper wire from the transmission lines down there. And otherwise, that village was burned down in 1962 in October after the first snow. During a snowstorm, they lit that fire and they burned the 60 homes. I have pictures of that. I think it's about time, isn't it?